one chance in 20. So the chance of getting the right bead in the first and second slot simultaneously is one chance in 20 squared. Getting the first three correct is one chance in 20 cubed, and getting all 100 correct is one chance in 20 to the 100th. Well, you can see 20 to the 100th is 2 to the 100th times 10 to the 100th. And since 2 to the 10th is 1,000, which is 10 cubed, then 2 to the 100th is 10 to the 30th. So this is the same as 10 to the 130th. One chance in 10 to the 130th of assembling the right molecules the first time. 10 to the 130th power, or 1 followed by 130 zeros, is vastly more than the total number of elementary particles in the entire universe, which is only about 10 to the 80th. So let's imagine that every star in the universe has a planetary system like ours. Let's say one planet has oceans. Let's suppose that the oceans are just as thick as ours. Let us suppose that there is a few percent solution of organic matter in every one of those oceans, and that in every tiny volume of that ocean that has enough molecules, there is an experiment happening once every microsecond to construct this particular 100 amino acid long protein. So in the ocean, every microsecond, an enormous number of these little experiments are going on. And identical things are happening in the next star system and the next star system, filling an entire galaxy. And then, not just in that galaxy, but in every galaxy in the universe. It turns out that if that sequence of experiments had gone on for the entire history of the universe, you could never produce one enzyme molecule of predetermined structure. And in fact, it's much worse than that. If you did that same experiment once every Planck time, the shortest unit of time that is permissible in physics, you still couldn't generate a single hemoglobin molecule from which many people have decided that God exists. Because how else do you make these molecules? If you haven't heard this before, doesn't this seem like a pretty compelling argument? Strong argument, right? A whole universe of experiments once every Planck time? Can't beat that. Now let's take another look. Does it matter if I have a hemoglobin molecule here and I pull out this aspartic acid and I put in a glutamic? Does that make the molecule function less well? In most cases, it doesn't. In most cases, an enzyme has a so-called active site, which is generally about 5 amino acids long. And it's the active site that does the stuff. And the rest of the molecule is involved in folding and turning the molecule on or turning it off. And it's not 100 places you have to explain. It's only 5 to get going. And 20 to the 5th is an absurdly small number, only about 3 million. Those experiments are done in one ocean between now and next Tuesday. Now, remember what it is we're trying to do. We're not trying to make a human being from scratch. To have all the molecules of human being fall simultaneously together in a primitive ocean and then have someone swim out of the water? That's not what we're asking for. What we're asking for is something that gets life going. So this enormously powerful sieve of Darwinian natural selection can start pulling out the natural experiments that work and encouraging them and neglecting the cases that don't work. So it turns out here, there is an important point that is left out in these apparent deductions of divine intervention by looking at the natural world. A very dramatic, strong statement of this sort has been made by the astronomers Fred Hoyle and N.C. Wickramasinghe. And their phrase, after a calculation in this spirit, goes something like this. They say it is no more likely that the origin of life could occur spontaneously by molecular interaction in the primitive ocean than that a Boeing 747 would be spontaneously assembled when a whirlwind passed over a junkyard. That's a vivid image. It's also a very useful image because, of course, the Boeing 747 did not spring full-blown into the world of aviation. It is the end product of a long evolutionary sequence, which, as you know, goes back to the DC-3 and so on until you get to the Wright biplane. Now, the Wright biplane does look as if it were spontaneously assembled by whirlwind in a junkyard. And while I don't mean to criticize the brilliant achievement of the Wright brothers, as long as you remember that there is this evolutionary history, it's a lot easier to understand the origin of the first example. I want to close on a beautiful little piece of poetry written by a woman in rural Arkansas. Her name is Lily Emery, and she is not a professional poet, but she writes for herself, and she has written to me. And one of her poems has the following lines in it. "My kind didn't really slither out of a tidal pool, did we? God, I need to believe you created me. We are so small down here." I think there is a very general truth that Lily Emery expresses in this poem. I believe everyone on some level recognizes that feeling. And yet, if we are merely matter, intricately assembled, is this really demeaning? If there's nothing in here but atoms, does that make us less? Or does that make matter more? 4. Extraterrestrial intelligence. There was a time when angels walked the earth. Now they cannot even be found in heaven. Yiddish proverb. If there is as a continuum from self-reproducing molecules, such as DNA, to microbes, and an evolutionary sequence continuum from microbes to humans, why should we imagine that continuum to stop at humans? Why should there be an open-ended gap in the spectrum of beings? And isn't it a little suspicious that the gap would begin with us? It's of interest to me that our language has not really any appropriate terms for such beings. The theological languages have terms like angels and demigods and seraphim and so on. Even here, it's interesting that the theological expectations of beings superior to humans generally represent a hierarchy of power, but not of intelligence. And here again, I think it is clear that we have imposed human values onto the universe. Certainly on this planet, it is not apparent that there are beings more intelligent than humans, although a case can be made for dolphins and whales. And in fact, if humans succeed in destroying themselves with nuclear weapons, a case could be made that all the other animals are smarter than humans. I would like to describe a famous case of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the search for beings more advanced than we, a case that failed. I want to explore why it failed, what lessons we can learn from this failure, and then move on to the modern search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I hope to stress where we have to be extremely careful, where we must demand the most stringent and rigorous standards of evidence precisely because we have profound emotional investments in the answer. Later, I will attempt to use those skeptical strictures to apply more directly to the more conventional God hypothesis. I suppose an equally good epigram for this subject is the following sentence said by John Adams, second president of the United States, but long before he was that. As a lawyer and an advocate, he argued in defense of the British soldiers who were being tried at the Boston Massacre trials in December 1770. And he did this not because he was in favor of the British cause. He wasn't. He defended those he opposed because he believed that the truth should be pursued above all other considerations. He said, "Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence." Well, sometimes they can, but we hope they can't. The year is 1877, let us imagine. The motion of the Earth around the Sun and Mars around the Sun has brought Mars and the Earth close together, as they tend to be at the intervals of roughly 17 years. An Italian astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli, looking through a newly completed and fairly large aperture telescope in Italy, was glancing at Mars and suddenly saw the surface of the planet reveal a profusion of intricate, fine, linear detail that a later observer described as being like the lines in a fine steel etching. Schiaparelli promptly called these lines canali, an Italian word meaning channels or grooves. We can understand how it was translated into English as canals, a word with a clear imputation of design, of intelligence, of vast engineering works constructed for a reason. The idea of canali on Mars was taken up by an American astronomer named Percival Lowell, a wealthy Bostonian. Lowell constructed a major observatory with funds out of his own pocket near Flagstaff, Arizona, called, naturally, the Lowell Observatory, to study these markings. Lowell was convinced that Schiaparelli was right, that the planet was covered by a network of intersecting single and double straight lines, that these lines passed over enormous distances and therefore could correspond only to engineering works on the most massive imaginable scale. Other observers also found the canals, that is, drew them. Photographing them was much more difficult. The argument was that atmospheric seeing was unreliable due to the intrinsic turbulence and unsteadiness of the Earth's atmosphere, which generally prevent you from seeing the canals. But every now and then, by chance, the atmosphere steadies, the turbulent eddies of air are not in your line of sight to Mars. And just for a moment, you can see the planet as it truly is with this network of straight lines. And then another bit of atmospheric turbulence comes by and the planetary image becomes shimmery and the details are lost. Lowell reasoned that a photograph which involves a time exposure that adds up the rare moments of good seeing with the much more plentiful moments of bad seeing would not reveal the canals. But the human eye can remember those instances of excellent seeing and reject the other moments, much more common, when the image is fading and blurring and distorting. And this is why, he argued, experienced observers skilled in drawing what they see at the telescope could obtain results that the photographic emulsion could not. There were other astronomers who, for the life of them, couldn't see the straight lines, but there was a range of explanations. They were not in the best sights for their telescopes. They were not experienced observers. They were not adequate draftsmen. They were biased against the idea of canals on Mars. Lowell and Schiaparelli were by no means the only astronomers who could find the canals. Astronomers all over the world saw them, drew them, mapped them, named them. And there were literally hundreds of individual canals that were named. There was a point of view that said that the canals were not really on Mars, that they represented some sophisticated failure of the human eye-brain combination, that Lowell and his confreres were too carried away by the power of the idea. Lowell, who was a superb, popular expositor, dismissed these objections in various ways and pointed to the remarkable similarity of the maps that he had drawn to those that other independent observers had drawn, say, for example, W.H. Wright at the Lick Observatory. Lowell argued that this convergence by quite separate observers with no prior collusion onto the same pattern of straight lines could only be due to something on Mars, not to something on the Earth. Lowell deduced from these straight lines an ancient civilization on Mars more advanced than we, having to face a planetary drought of proportions unprecedented on Earth. And their solution was to construct a vast, globe-girdling network of canals to carry liquid water from the melting polar caps to the thirsty inhabitants of the equatorial cities. What's more, it was possible to conclude, Lowell thought, something of the politics of the Martians, because the network crossed the entire planet. Therefore, there was a world government on Mars, at least as far as engineering detail went, and Lowell went so far as to be able to identify the capital of Mars, a particular spot on the surface called Solis Lacus, the Lake of the Sun, from which 6 or 8 different canals seemed to emanate. Now, this is a lovely story. It passed into popular consciousness, into folk literature, was most powerfully impressed on the global consciousness through H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds, through a set of science fiction novels by Edgar Rice Burroughs, the man who invented Tarzan, and then, in 1938, by Orson Welles's War of the Worlds, broadcast in America on the eve of the Nazi invasion of Europe, at a time when fears of distinctly terrestrial, not extraterrestrial invasion, were in everybody's mind. And yet, there are no canals on Mars. Not one. The whole thing is wrong. It's a mistake. It is a failure of the human hand-eye brain combination. Lowell's idea evoked a passion, I think a very understandable and humane passion. The vision of more advanced beings on a neighboring planet with a world government struggling to keep themselves alive was a wonderful idea. It was so wonderful that the wish to believe it trumped the scrupulousness of the investigative process. So what can we conclude from this? Well, we can conclude that in a sense, Lowell was right, that the canals of Mars are a sign of intelligent life. The only question is, which side of the telescope the intelligent life is on? And as we see, the intelligent life was on our end of the telescope. People staked their careers on an observable phenomenon, apparently reproducible by others in quite different parts of the world. A huge public concern and interest were generated. This was only one of several different arguments for intelligent life on Mars today, all of which are mistaken. If scientists can be fooled on the question of the simple interpretation of straightforward data, of the sort that they are routinely obtaining from other kinds of astronomical objects, when the stakes are high, when the emotional predispositions are working, what must be the situation where the evidence is much weaker, where the will to believe is much greater, where the skeptical scientific tradition has hardly made a toehold, namely in the area of religion? Let's think about the question of extraterrestrial intelligence. There are several approaches. There is one that says, well, it is a vast universe. There must be beings much smarter than we are. They must have capabilities vastly in excess of ours. Therefore, they should be able to come here. If we are poking around in neighboring worlds in our planetary system, then should not intelligent beings elsewhere in our solar system, as Lowell thought, or in other planetary systems, of which we now know there are many, shouldn't they be visiting here? And that then takes us to the issue of unidentified flying objects and ancient astronauts, which we will get to. But here, I would like to concentrate on what is now the mainstream scientific approach to the issue of extraterrestrial intelligence, one that I should say from the beginning, I have been deeply involved in and support wholeheartedly. But at the same time, I think it sheds light on this question of what is suitable evidence and what isn't. At what moment do we say that the evidence is sufficient to deduce the presence of extraterrestrial intelligence? I believe that while the details are slightly different, the argument is not significantly different from the question, what would be convincing evidence of the existence of an angel or a demigod or a god? First off, there's the question, is it plausible? That is, whatever you do to search for extraterrestrial intelligence, it is going to cost some money. You want a plausibility argument first, that it makes at least a little sense. Clearly, were we to find extraterrestrial intelligence, this would be a discovery of enormous importance scientifically, philosophically, and, I maintain, theologically. But you'd want to have some expectation of success, some argument to counter skeptics who might say, there was no evidence that we have been visited, therefore it is a waste of time. So what we would really like to know is how many sites of intelligent beings, more intelligent than we, there are in, say, the Milky Way galaxy. And how far is it from here to the nearest one? If it turns out that the nearest one is some immense distance away, let's say, at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, 30,000 light years, then we might conclude that the prospects of contact are small. On the other hand, if it turns out that the nearest such civilization is relatively nearby, let's say, a few tens or even a few hundreds of light years, then it might make sense in some way, which I'll go into to try to search for it. Now, a convenient approach to this issue, it is hardly precise, is what is called the Drake equation, after the astronomer Frank Drake, who has been a pioneer in the scientific approach to this question, and it goes roughly like this. There is a number, call it N, of technical civilizations in the galaxy, civilizations with the technology to permit interstellar contact. That technology, essentially, is radio astronomy. That number is N equals R times F sub P times N sub P times F sub L times F sub I times F sub C times L, the product of a set of factors, each of which I will define. All that is involved in this equation is the idea that a collective probability is the product of the individual probabilities, quite like what we were talking about earlier on the probability that the right amino acid is in the first slot in the protein and in the second slot and in the third slot, and then you multiply those probabilities. The chance that you'll get heads in the first coin toss is one half. The chance that you'll get heads in the second toss is one half. The chance that you will get two consecutive heads is a quarter. Three consecutive heads is an eighth, and so on. So the number of such civilizations depends on the rate of star formation, which we call R. The more stars that are formed, the more potential abodes for life there will be if they have planetary systems. That seems clear. Multiply that figure times F sub P, the fraction of stars that have planetary systems. But it's not good enough just to have planets. They have to be suitable for life. So, multiply by N sub P, the number of planets in an average system that are ecologically suitable for the origin of life. Then, times F sub L, the fraction of such worlds in which life actually arises, times F sub I, the fraction of which worlds in which over their lifetime, intelligent life evolves, times F sub C, the fraction of such worlds in which the intelligent life develops a technical communicative capability, times L, the lifetimes of technical civilization. Because clearly, if civilizations destroy themselves as soon as they are formed, everything else may go swimmingly well, and yet there will be nobody for us to talk to. So, let me give my wild guesses about what these numbers are. I stress that we don't know these numbers very well, that our uncertainty progressively increases as we go from the leftmost to the rightmost factor, and that the largest uncertainty by far is in L, the lifetime of a technical civilization. There are some 100,000 million stars in the Milky Way galaxy. The lifetime of the Milky Way galaxy is something like 10,000 million years, and therefore, a modest averaged estimate of the rate of star formation is about 10 stars per year. A very interesting number that, by itself. Every year, there are 10 new suns that are born in the Milky Way galaxy, and many of them probably with planetary systems, and billions of years from now, maybe they will have life. On the question of the fraction of stars that have planets going around them, I previously talked about the burgeoning recent evidence from ground-based and space-based observatories for planetary systems, both those just forming and ones that are fully formed around nearby stars. The statistics are remarkable. The IRAS satellite data alone suggests that something like a quarter of nearby main sequence stars, a little younger than the sun, have something like a solar nebula in the process of formation. It's an amazingly large number. and any of them that have fully formed planetary systems we can detect only in certain special cases. You would not expect that every star has a planetary system, but the number looks very large. Just for the sake of argument, I'll take the fraction F sub P to be something like a half. Now consider the number of planets per system that are in principle suitable for the origin of life. Well, certainly in our system, we know at least one, the Earth. And good arguments can be made that it is possible on other planets, on other bodies. We talked about Titan. There's an argument for Mars. Not to pretend any kind of accuracy, but just so that we can put in numbers that easily multiply each other. Let us take that number, n sub p, as 2. The fraction of ecologically suitable planets in which life actually does arise over a period of hundreds of millions or thousands of millions of years, I will take to be very high on the basis of sorts of arguments I made earlier, especially the speed with which the origin of life seemed to have happened on this planet. So I'll take F sub L to be around 1. And now we come to more difficult numbers. Life has arisen on a given planet, and you have thousands of millions of years in which the environment is somewhat stable. How likely is it that intelligence and technical civilizations arise? On the one hand, we might argue that there are a sequence of individually unlikely events that must happen for humans to evolve. For example, the dinosaurs had to be extinguished because they were the dominant organisms on the planet, and our ancestors in the times of the dinosaurs were furry, scurrying, burrowing creatures about the size of mice. And it is only because of the extinction of the dinosaurs that our ancestors could get going. And the extinction of the dinosaurs seems to have been caused by an immense collision by an asteroid or cometary nucleus with the Earth some 65 million years ago at the end of the Cretaceous period. That is a statistical event. And if that had not happened, maybe I would be 10 feet tall with green scales and sharp pointy teeth, and you would be similarly tall and green and pointy-toothed. We would both likely consider ourselves extremely attractive. What handsome fellows we are. And how strange it would seem if I proposed that, had things gone differently, then the little mice that bother us might have evolved to become the dominant organism, and the only remnants of us would be salamanders and crocodiles and birds. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there is no reason to think that there is only one path to intelligent life. The selective advantage of intelligence is clearly high. Other things being equal, if you can figure the world out, you have a better chance of survival, at least until the invention of nuclear weapons. Human brains comprise a significant fraction of our body mass, more than for almost any other animal on the planet. And this then suggests a progressive development of brains to figure out the world. The more data processing, the more chances for survival we have. There is no reason to think that this is a peculiarly human situation, and it ought to be true on other planets as well. So then we come to the question, if you have intelligent life, is it guaranteed to develop technical civilizations? Clearly not. The dolphins and whales are intelligent, based on many different anecdotal accounts, and on the argument of brain mass to body mass ratio. And yet, they have built nothing, because they don't have hands and they live in a different environment than we do. It is easy to imagine a world full of poets who do not build radio telescopes. They're very smart, but we don't hear from them. So, not every intelligent life form need be technological or communicative. What this product of F sub I times F sub C is, no one really knows. We can certainly point out that it took most of the history of the Earth before ornithoides or cetacea or primates developed. They all developed in the last few tens of millions of years. Why did it take so long? Well, there's probably a certain degree of complexity that is essential for being able to figure things out. On the other hand, the Earth and the solar system have thousands of millions of years more ahead of them, and so do other planets as well. A number for F sub I times F sub C that I believe to be modest is 1/100th, 1%. I do not at all say that I know what these numbers are. These are merely rough estimates to collect the various uncertainties together. I do not claim this is holy writ. If we multiply these numbers together, 10 times 1/2 times 2 times 1 times 1/100th, the product is a tenth. So the number n of technical civilizations in our galaxy would be 1/10 times their average lifetime, L, in years. L is in years because R was 10 stars per year, and the product must not have any years in it, just the number of civilizations. So what is L? What is the lifetime of a technical civilization? We have had radio telescopes for only the last few decades. An argument could be made by reading the daily newspapers, among other things, that our civilization is in great peril, and therefore that, for the Earth at least, the lifetime of a technical civilization in this sense is a decade or a few decades. And if that number were typical for civilizations in general, then L would be, let's say, a decade, 10 years. So let's call this the most pessimistic root. A tenth times 10 is 1, and the number of technical civilizations in the galaxy would be 1. Where is it? It's us. So there's nobody to talk to except ourselves, and we hardly do that very well. In that case, if you believe that argument, it would be foolish to make a massive or expensive search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because even if this number L were a few decades, the number of civilizations would be only a few, and therefore the distance to the nearest one would be enormously far away. Now let's take another route, the optimistic one, and that is, it seems perfectly possible that we are able to solve the issues of the technological adolescence that confront us. And even if there's only a small chance of doing that, say 1%, 1% of all those civilizations in the galaxy living for very long periods of time implies a very large number. Suppose that 1% of civilizations lived for evolutionary or geological or stellar evolutionary timescales, say, billions of years. If there's only 1% that do that, then the average lifetime would be 1% of 10 to the 9th, which is 10 to the 7th. So 10 million years would be the value for L. Multiply that by a tenth, and the answer would be a million. 10 to the 6th civilizations in the galaxy. A vastly different story. So you can see that while there are significant uncertainties for each of these factors, by far the largest uncertainty, the place we have the least experience, none whatever as a matter of fact, is in the average lifetime of a technical civilization. And it is this connection of L with the number of civilizations and the distance to the nearest one that in a remarkable way binds up this quite outre subject of extraterrestrial intelligence with the most pressing human concerns. Because it means that the receipt of a message, never mind being able to decode it, from elsewhere would say that L is probably a large number, that someone has been able to survive technological adolescence. It would be knowledge very much worth having. If there are a million technical civilizations in the galaxy, then you can readily calculate to first order, just extracting a cube root, the distance to the nearest civilization. If they are randomly distributed through the galaxy, and we know how many stars there are in a galaxy, how far to the nearest one? And the answer is, it's just a few hundred light years away. It's next door. It's not next door as far as visiting, but it's next door as far as radio communication. Now, even a few hundred light years away means that we must not imagine much in the way of dialogue. It's more monologue. They talk, we listen, because otherwise they would say, let us imagine, hello, how are you? And we would say, fine, thank you, and you? And that exchange would take, say, 600 years. It's not what you might call a snappy conversation. On the other hand, it's very clear that one-way transmission of information is something that can be enormously valuable. Aristotle talks to us. We do not, except for spiritualists, talk to Aristotle. And I have grave doubts about the spiritualists, although Aristotle is almost never on their list of contacts. Now, let's therefore say a few more words about this idea of radio communication. What we imagine is that beings on a planet of another star know that emerging civilizations will stumble upon radio. It's part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It is, as I will show you in a moment, a clear channel through the galaxy. The technology is relatively simple and inexpensive. Radio waves travel at the speed of light, faster than which nothing can go, so far as we know. The information that can be transmitted is enormous, not just, hello, how are you? Put another way, if an identical system were at the center of the galaxy, and we were here using our present detection technology, we could pick up that signal coming from thousands of light years away. It gives you an idea of the remarkable power of this technology, which has in fact been only lately brought up to its actual capabilities. There is a question of frequency. What channel would you listen on? There's an enormous number of possible radio frequencies. We have here the radio frequency spectrum in gigahertz, thousands of millions of cycles per second against the noise background from various sources in degrees absolute. And what we see is that at the low frequencies, there's a background from charged particles in magnetic fields in the galaxy, the galactic background. It's noise. And it gets to be very substantial noise. This is not where you would want to transmit or receive. At the high frequency end, there is another source of noise intrinsic to the quantum nature of radio detectors. And in the middle, there is a broad region where the noise is low. And this is the window in which it makes sense to transmit. In this window, there are certain spectral lines, for example, of atomic hydrogen, the most abundant atom in the universe, at specific frequencies. So for this reason, there is now a very sophisticated search program going on at Harvard in Massachusetts, a cooperative project with Harvard University and the Planetary Society, a 100,000 member worldwide organization. And it is remarkable that dues and contributions to a private organization are able to maintain by far the most sophisticated search for extraterrestrial intelligence yet attempted. You listen at many frequencies for a while and see if there's anything happening. The Planetary Society system was recently upgraded so that 8.4 million separate channels are being listened to simultaneously. The antenna points to some part of the sky, and some places have peaks. They may be due to radio interference on the Earth, satellites in Earth orbit, automobile ignitions, diathermy machines, but each of those has a particular kind of signature, and it is possible to imagine signals that don't look like any of those things, which the computer immediately would cull out of the noise, leaving no doubt that this was an artificial signal of extraterrestrial origin, even if we had no opportunity, no ability to understand what it meant. Now, as I said, the expectation is that they send, and we, newly emerged, the youngest communicative civilization in the galaxy, we listen, not the other way around. Let me stress that this is the one respect in which our civilization is probably unique in the galaxy. No one even slightly more ignorant can communicate at all. Let me say this in a better way. A civilization only a few decades behind us would not have radio astronomy and therefore could not tumble to this technique. Or maybe they could tumble to it, but they couldn't manifest it. And anyone, therefore, whom we hear from is likely to be ahead of us, because if they're even a little bit behind us, they can't communicate at all. So the most likely situation is communications from beings vastly more advanced than us. And this, therefore, raises the question, could we possibly understand what they're saying? What we have to remember here is that if this is an intentional message from them to us, then they can make it easy. They can make allowances for civilizations. And if they do not choose to do that, then we will not understand the message. Maybe you would say advanced civilizations communicate with each other by zeta waves. And I'd say, what is a zeta wave? And you reply, it is something fantastic for communication that I can't give you any details about because it won't be invented for another 5,000 years. Well, that's wonderful. And if those fellows can communicate with zeta waves, that's terrific. But if they wish to communicate with us, they will have to wheel out some ancient, creaking radio telescope from the Technology Museum and use it, because that is all that young civilizations will be able to understand and detect. Now, suppose we get a message. What would it be like? Here's a possibility. There would be a powerful beacon or announcement signal, something that makes it very clear that we are unambiguously receiving a message from an advanced civilization. It might, for example, be highly monochromatic, that is, a very narrow radio frequency bandpass, and or it might be a sequence of pulses that could not possibly be of natural origin. For example, a sequence of prime numbers, numbers divisible only by one and themselves, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, and so on. There is no natural process that could produce such numbers. Then, having established unambiguously that the message was from intelligent beings in space, it is perfectly possible to imagine a vast amount of additional information conveyed in ways that we can understand. For example, it is perfectly possible to transmit pictures. In fact, it's done by radio all the time. That's what your television set does. It is possible to send mathematics. It's very easy. I mean, suppose they set out the numbers. Beep, that's one. Beep, beep, that's two. Beep, 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 that's three, and so on. And then they do. I'm just going to make this up. Beep, glugga, beep, wonk, beep, beep. Well, a few more like that, and you decide a glaga means plus, and wonk means equal. But suppose they now do beep, glaga, beep, beep, wonk, beep, beep. And then there's some symbol after that. That symbol, that new symbol, must mean false. And you can immediately see that abstract concepts like true and false could be communicated very quickly. And between these two modes, the use of mathematics, which we would, of course, share in common, and the transmission of pictures, it is possible that a very rich message could be conveyed. What that message would be, clearly none of us are in a position to say. Now, I would like you to just think about contrasting this open-minded experimental approach, which consists of some plausibility arguments that no one takes too seriously, with the more traditional approach to intelligent life in space, the one in which there are no experiments, in which there is no withholding of opinion until the evidence is seen, in which we are asked merely to take it on faith. The contrast is, in my opinion, very stark. There is quite a different approach and method, and I remind you about how powerfully we were fooled by the Martian canal situation, where passions and emotions were heavily engaged. What do they look like? There is a standard in Hollywood convention that extraterrestrials look just like us. Well, maybe they have pointy ears or antenna or green skin, but those are minor cosmetic variations. Extraterrestrials and humans are fundamentally the same. Why should they be? Look at the long sequence of stochastic random events that led to our evolution. I mentioned the extinction of the dinosaurs. That's one. Take another. We have 10 fingers, and that's why we use base 10 arithmetic. nothing special about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then 1, 0, except we count on our fingers. Why do we have 10 fingers? Because we evolved from a Devonian fish that had 10 phalanges in its fins. If we evolved from a Devonian fish that had 12 phalanges, then we'd all be doing base 12 arithmetic, and base 10 arithmetic would be considered only by mathematicians. This is true at every level, including biochemical levels, to such an extent that I think it is fair to say, never mind some other planet, if you started the Earth out again and let just these random factors operate, such as when a cosmic ray would strike a chromosome, producing a mutation in the hereditary material, you might wind up with intelligent beings after some thousands of millions of years. You might wind up with creatures of high ethical and artistic or theological accomplishment, but they would not look anything like human beings. We are the products of a unique evolutionary sequence. Unique doesn't mean better, it just means unique. Elsewhere, different environment, different necessity to adapt to changing conditions, a different sequence of random events, including random genetic events, and we should not expect anything like a human being. Now, what about religion? What about the idea that we are all made in God's image? Is that also a failure of the imagination? What do we mean when we say we are made in God's image? Do we, for example, imagine that God has nostrils and breathes? If so, what does he breathe? Air? Where is the air? Air with oxygen in it? No other planet in the solar system has oxygen except the Earth. Why restrict God to very few places? Why would he need nostrils? What about a navel? Would God have a navel? What about hair? What about a vermiform appendix? What about toes? Toes are clearly the result of our ancestors' life in the canopy of the high forest, swinging from branch to branch. Very good to have four limbs that can hold on to trees. We just happen to have the toes in this particular transitional moment. Big toe is good for balance. Little toe is not good for very much at all. It's just an evolutionary accident. Vermiform appendix? Likewise, good for nothing. It's just on its way out. Arthur Clarke has said that Christian orthodoxy is too narrow and timid for what is likely to be found in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He has said that the doctrine of man made in the image of God is ticking like a time bomb at Christianity's base, set to explode if other intelligent creatures are discovered. I don't in the least agree. I think that the only sense that can be put on the phrase made in God's image is that there is a sense of intellectual affinity between us and higher organisms, if such there be. The same laws of physics apply everywhere. If we imagine those extraterrestrial beings sending us radio messages, we and they have something in common. We must. The very act of receiving the message means that we have radio technology in common. We have quantum mechanics. We have atomic physics. We have Newtonian gravitation. We can see that those laws of nature apply everywhere in the universe. It's not a question of what your biology is like. It's not a question of the sequence of events that led you to getting a technical civilization. The mere fact that you have a technical civilization means that you have come to grips to some extent with the universe as it really is. And so it is in that sense, and in that sense alone, I believe, that it makes sense to talk about such an affinity between advanced beings and ourselves. 5. Extraterrestrial folklore, implications for the evolution of religion. I consider the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence a subject of philosophical, scientific, and even historical importance. If we were so lucky as to receive some sign of extraterrestrial intelligence, I think there is little doubt that it would be an extremely significant historical event. And if, on the other hand, we were to make a detailed and comprehensive search to no avail, that would also be something worth knowing. It would say something about the rarity and preciousness of intelligent life, and again, I believe, would have extremely important and beneficial social consequences. Therefore, the search for extraterrestrial life is one of those few circumstances where both a success and a failure would be a success by all standards. So I am hardly opposed to the idea of extraterrestrials visiting us. If we ourselves are poking around our solar system, if we are capable, as we are, of sending our own spacecraft not just to the other planets in our solar system, but beyond our solar system to the stars, then surely other civilizations, if they exist, thousands or millions of years more advanced than ours, ought to be able to achieve interstellar spaceflight much more readily, much more swiftly. And I don't for a moment deny this as a possibility. I would stress that the economy of effort is far greater for radio communication than direct communication by interstellar spacecraft. I would argue that you can broadcast to millions or thousands of millions of worlds simultaneously, speedily, inexpensively, in a way that even for a very advanced civilization would be much more difficult and costly to do via interstellar spacecraft. However, I certainly could not exclude the possibility that the Earth is now or once was visited. But precisely because the stakes in the answer are high, precisely because this is an issue that engages powerful emotions, we would in this case demand only the most scrupulous standards of evidence. I want to discuss two modern hypotheses that I think are proper to call folklore: the ancient astronaut hypothesis and the UFO, or unidentified flying object, hypothesis, and then attempt to connect them with the history of slightly more conventional religions. The ancient astronaut hypothesis was popularized most effectively by a Swiss hotelier named Erich von Däniken, and his works, the first of which was called Chariots of the Gods, the question mark becoming suppressed in subsequent printings, were huge bestsellers in the late 1960s, early 1970s, selling worldwide tens of millions of copies, an enormously successful set of books. The fundamental hypothesis of von Däniken was that there is impressed in the archaeology and folklore and myth of many civilizations on Earth certain indications of past contact with the Earth by extraterrestrial beings. This is not an absurd proposition on the face of it, but how acceptable the hypothesis is depends on how good the evidence is. And, unfortunately, the standards of evidence were extremely poor, in many cases non-existent. So, to give an example, and I promise I am not burlesquing the argument as I describe it, here is von Däniken's approach to the pyramids of Egypt. "The pyramids of Egypt," he said, "are constructed of individual blocks, rectangular, parallelopipeds, each of which weighs 20 tons, or thereabouts." 20 tons, he said. That's extremely heavy. Individual persons could not lift a 20-ton block, much less many of them, to make a pyramid. Therefore, modern construction equipment is necessary. And in 2000 to 3000 BC, that could only be of extraterrestrial manufacture. Hence, extraterrestrials exist. Now, we can recognize that this argument neglects certain facts. If we knew nothing of Egyptian archaeology, we could nevertheless imagine ways in which large numbers of people could build massive edifices. The Bible, after all, refers to ambitious construction projects, for example, the enormous Tower of Babel. And then, when we look at the internal evidence, or even read Herodotus, who alluded to Egyptian pyramid construction techniques, we find that there is an entirely self-consistent and perfectly natural explanation. In fact, there are many, some of which involve sending rafts up the Nile and rollers to move the blocks and the removal of underlying material. There were even inscriptions on a few key blocks that say the equivalent of, "My goodness, we did it," signed Tiger Team 11, which seems an unlikely delight in modest construction by some being who had effortlessly traveled through interstellar space. And we know that the first pyramid that was ever constructed fell down, and that the second pyramid, halfway through construction, had the angle of the sides dramatically paired, because they had learned from the example of the first one that fell down. Again, an error of exceeding the angle of repose was unlikely to be made by an extraterrestrial spacefaring civilization. Von Däniken noted that in Peru, in the plains of Nazca, there are large drawings on the desert that can properly be seen only from a great altitude. And they depict nothing very extraordinary in themselves, turkeys, condors, and other natural beasts and vegetables. But Von Däniken wonders why anyone would construct something that could be seen only from a great altitude, from which he deduces not only that there were beings at a great altitude to see it, but that such beings directed the construction, saying, "A little to the left." Now, in American football games, it is customary for people to be outfitted, each, with a square of cardboard on which is the fragment of a line or a letter. And at the appropriate moment, everybody holds up their piece, and from a great distance, some symbol, generally having to do with the hope for success of the home team, is displayed. And yet no one deduces extraterrestrial intervention in such a case. Or, Von Däniken noted, that in the Pacific, on Easter Island,